Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. All right, quick, what's a four-letter word for global trade? Try this, TPP. Yeah, no, I know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 24th day of August. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. There are, and this... yes, is just a guess, but there are probably hundreds of specific policy points on which Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton disagree. One of those points, though, is distinctly not global trade. Both Secretary Clinton and Mr. Trump have promised, with varying degrees of specificity, that they will make our trading relationships better. Both of them oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Obama administration's big trade deal now languishing in the halls of Congress. That opposition from each of his potential successors and from a good-sized slice of the Congress of the United States of America comes even as the White House is promising a push for ratification after the election. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains how that might go.
The fact that both nominees of the major parties are adamantly opposed to the TPP has made the future very unclear for supporters of free trade.
It's really dialed up the pressure to try to pass the deal in the lame duck session.
Lame duck session meaning after the election. That's Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
So I think what they're doing is plying a lot of backdoor channels to try to get legislators to support them once the election's over.
Agricultural producers are pushing representatives of rural areas hard in favor of passage. Dale Moore is with the American Farm Bureau Federation, and he says some Americans have a lot to gain from the TPP.
When it's fully implemented, we're looking at an increase in cash receipts for farmers and ranchers, nearly $8.5 billion annually. We're seeing about $5.3 billion in increased net exports for agriculture.
Even so, the political atmosphere isn't helping the case, says Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute.
The persistent rhetoric, the fact that there's no support for this at the top of either of the tickets, has made it very difficult for senators who are up for re-election to embrace the TPP.
Eikenson says Republicans who would be President Obama's allies on the TPP have been turned off by concessions the president made in TPP negotiations to attract some Democrats. President Obama reduced certain protections for the tobacco, pharma, and finance industries.
He didn't win any Democratic support at all from that move, and he lost a lot of Republican support, so it sort of backfired.
Even those who aren't fans of the TPP, like Jared Bernstein, say the arguments for passage may now shift away from economics and a little more toward geopolitics.
This is the idea that if we don't make the rules, China will, and will dominate Asian markets.
Just how compelling this and other arguments prove to be will be determined most likely sometime between Election Day and the end of the year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The vote yesterday was 3-1 in the National Labor Relations Board that graduate student research and teaching assistants at Columbia University are, in fact, employees of that school and so have the right to unionize. Graduate student unions have been recognized at public universities for more than 45 years, but at private schools, only NYU, New York University, has agreed to recognize its union. And that is a fact that is likely to change real soon. From our education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
At Yale University, grad students have been bargaining informally for years. They've won health insurance and domestic partner benefits and teacher training. Aaron Greenberg is a PhD candidate in political science and chair of the grad student union. He says yesterday's ruling paves the way to formal collective bargaining.
This is a historic decision that is going to affect tens of thousands of graduate employees across the country.
Grad students have become a go-to source of cheap labor for universities, and they're doing more of the teaching and research. Gordon Lafer is a former grad student organizer who now teaches labor policy at the University of Oregon. He says less than a third of college instructors today are tenured professors, and that's been a double-edged sword for people getting their PhDs.
Because on the one hand, you are the low-wage labor force while you're doing your PhD, whether that's in teaching or research. And on the other hand, when you get out, you have less chance of getting a real tenure-track job because so many of those have been replaced by graduate students and part-timers.
But colleges say the ruling could decrease work opportunities for all students on campus. Peter McDonough is general counsel with the American Council on Education. He says the decision suggests any students with campus jobs, not just grad students, have the right to organize.
The floodgates essentially are open. The opportunity exists for every person who is an employee, whether a student or not, on a campus to be represented.
McDonough says union representation itself isn't bad, but he says it is likely to increase labor and administrative costs, which will be passed on to students. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks were down, oil was down, precious metals were down. Traders pretty much sitting on their hands waiting, in the absence of anything else, for a big speech coming Friday from Fed Chair Janet Yellen, tea leaf reading and all of that, which was going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Southeast Louisiana is still cleaning up from all the flooding it had the past week or so as regular life and businesses there start to slowly get back to normal. Horst Pfeiffer owns Middendorf's restaurant. It's sort of between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Mr. Pfeiffer, it's good to talk to you, sir.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
First of all, this storm and all this flooding caught you in the middle of renovations to make the restaurant drier, I guess, right? What's going on with
that? We call it higher and drier. Actually, today we're putting pilings in there. And caught us in the middle, but we were in the middle, so you couldn't stop in the middle.
Yeah. Flooding, though, is nothing new to Middendorf, right? I mean, you bought the place in 2007. How many times you've been flooded since then?
Three times. That's why I'm building higher and drier. I don't want to depend on anybody else, and it's all up to me to make sure that doesn't happen to me again.
I believe it. How much higher can you go, though, sir? Because this is not going to be the last time you flood.
Well, from the biggest flood we had, I have 2.5 feet. Now, if I get 2.5 more feet here at Middendorf, we get the Gulf water coming into Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
But the water is strange. You never know how the wind blows, where it's going. Even you think it goes downhill, not necessarily.
Yeah. In the best of times, that is to say the dry times, how many people you have working in Middendorf for you?
We have 75 employees.
Wow. So what are they doing now while you're renovating and dealing with the flooding?
Well, the one thing is what we did. We normally have outside for boaters a deck where they eat, and it's normally counter service. So I took when I took my old building down, I put air conditioning out there. So I keep all the employees employed to get a full paycheck. And the toughest time the last few days was people who were necessarily not flooded, but couldn't come to work. It's hard for everybody right now with people cleaning out their houses. At the same time, you have to work to make a living. I mean, the last 2 weeks for us, not only the flooding, but also, we're doing maybe only 10-20% of normal business.
How are you getting by then? I mean, obviously, you made the decision to do the renovations, but also the rain and the water has taken what's left of your business away.
Well, the one thing is, I tell one thing, when 9/11 hit, I always had a cash reserves for devastating times. And then when Katrina hit, I increased it where I want to make sure I have plenty enough to hold on for at least 6-7 months. Or money I put on the side for in case something happened.
Yeah.
Since even if you don't get hit, the impact it has, a storm, from not having business, taking care of your employees and everything else. You know, it's keep on going, the pace going. And we have to do it ourselves and be smart about it, not lean on everybody else.
Last thing before I let you go, sir, I understand you guys make a mean catfish down there. You want to share your recipe with me or what?
Well, it's not mean. It's the world's best catfish, the world's famous thin-fried catfish. We're cutting the cat. You know, a lot of people either you like catfish or you don't like catfish.
Yeah.
And when you come to us, you love it, since we're cutting it thin.
Yep.
Then we're marinating it, and we just slightly dusted with cornmeal. And when you break it, it's wonderful. You break it in half, and you get the sweetness of the corn and the beautiful flavor of this thin-cut catfish, and we cut all the blood and the fat out of it, so it doesn't taste like catfish, and it's absolutely incredible.
Well, I'll tell you what. Next time I'm down in Acres, Louisiana, I'll stop by, all right?
Okay.
All right. Sir Horst Pfeiffer, he's the owner of Mindorf's Restaurant in Acres, Louisiana. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We are, as of this writing, 2 months and a day post-Brexit vote. So, obviously, early days yet. When the UK does finally leave the European Union, though, it is going to be a long and painful process. Right here and right now, though, what do we know about the very short-term impact of the completely surprising way that vote turned out? From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on that one.
This small British manufacturer has just made a surprising breakthrough. It sold some of its products to the United States. That's surprising because they're products with which most Brits think the US is already very well supplied.
This gun's also got a selectable trigger, so we can fire one barrel, second barrel.
James Longthorne Stewart and his wife Elaine make bespoke shotguns, classy, highly crafted, and at up to $50,000 a pop, pretty expensive. There's little doubt what has suddenly piqued interest from America.
We did actually get an order last week from a gentleman who rang up and ordered a gun because the pound is very low at the moment. And the gentleman wants to pay up front as well because the pound's so low, which is going to be really good for him.
You've never had that before, the customer wanting to pay everything up front.
It's rare, very rare, but we don't mind.
Longthorne Guns is one of many British exporters that have gotten a boost from the steep slide in sterling after the vote for Brexit. Adam Marshall of the British Chambers of Commerce.
For those who are getting their raw materials here in the UK and then pricing their goods in sterling, they're having a great time right now. They're out there in global markets selling more cheaply and they're actually quite confident.
Next, please.
Consumers seem confident too. In the month following the vote, retail sales were up nearly 6%. Unemployment's down as well at the lowest level for a decade. It's all a very far cry from the dire warnings before the referendum. A slew of experts forecast disaster if people opted to leave the EU. The stock market would crash, house prices plummet, 3 million people would be thrown onto the dole. They simply got it wrong, says pro-Brexit economist Gerard Lyons.
Predictions or prophecies of financial Armageddon were clearly overdone, not just in terms of jobs data, but more particularly in the way financial markets have behaved since the referendum.
But it's too soon for the Brexiters to gloat. Many analysts believe that business sentiment is not as buoyant as some of the figures might suggest. It will be 2 years or more before we know the shape of Britain's new relationship with the EU, its largest market. And that, says Rupert Harrison of the BlackRock investment firm, is weighing on business minds.
It's the uncertainty facing businesses that they think, I can't invest, I can't hire that person, I'm just going to wait and see what happens. That's what is happening at the moment.
Indeed, in spite of all the benign data, a key forward-looking indicator is flashing red. The Market Purchasing Managers Index, reflecting confidence in manufacturing and services, has seen a very sharp fall in the weeks after the referendum. Market's chief economist is Chris Williamson.
The only other times that we've seen this index fall to these low levels was the global financial crisis of 2008-2009, the bursting of the dot-com bubble, and the 1998 Asian financial crisis.
Confidence, as ever, is the key to economic success and all the other glittering prizes.
Gold for Great Britain! Gold for Christmas!
After Britain's stellar performance in Rio, the British government says it wants to harness the Olympic spirit for the long economic haul ahead. After winning gold at running, jumping, cycling, rowing and swimming, the hope is the Brits can now excel themselves in walking out of the EU and standing alone. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The military has become the nation's one-stop shopping. There's absolutely nothing the American military doesn't do now.
What's that saying? You can do one thing well or a whole lot of things half-assed? Never mind. Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off a 3% today, 65 points, 18,481. That's the same forwards and backwards, by the way. The NASDAQ fell 0.8%, 42 points, 52.17. The S&P 500 gave back about 0.5%, 11 points, 21.75. Financial firms didn't let the Fed guessing game get in the way of making money. Oh, no, thank you. Bank of America added a 3%. Morgan Stanley stepped up 0.6% today. Mylan got stuck again as the outcry over the price of EpiPens went all the way to the White House. Prices for the allergy treatment found in many a school backpack have soared 400% or more in the past decade. The stock, on the other hand, is down 5% today, 10% for the week. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note at 1.56%. At the close, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Think for a moment, would you, about how you get around, physically, how you get from here to there. The gas in our tanks, the asphalt on our roads, the rubber in our shoes, all of them depend in one way or another on oil. But oil itself only gets around a couple of ways, each of them controversial. When U.S. crude production jumped a couple of years ago, using trains to ship oil got a big bump, as did derailments and explosions and fires. And in some parts of the country now, oil shipments by rail are on the decline. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim has that story.
You could feel pretty strongly about trains, as evidenced by a YouTube user who refers to himself as Excited Train Guy.
Yeah, listen to that bell. Oh, take a look at that.
Wait for it.
Oh, my God! Woo! Listen to that horn! Oh, my God! Oh, she's beautiful!
Trains don't thrill everyone. Many especially dislike the tanker trains carrying oil through their communities. Brett Vandenhoevel is executive director of Columbia Riverkeeper. He's against all the traffic running through the Pacific Northwest.
We think oil trains are dangerous. You know, we've seen explosions very close to our homes here on the Columbia River and have watched explosions and derailments all over the nation, and we think it's not a safe way to transport oil.
A lot of attention has gone to oil trains recently and their safety issues, but nationally, the number of trains carrying oil is actually lessening. Not because of restrictions, it's because oil by rail itself is on the decline. Oil from the Bakken Shale in North Dakota ramped up production and availability faster than pipelines could be built. Trains filled in the gap. At its peak in October of 2014, oil by rail moved more than 29 million barrels. That's according to Arup Malik, an industry economist at the Energy Information Administration. He checked his computer for the latest numbers.
Within the U.S., we're moving about 12 million barrels in May, and that compares with last May, the intermovement within the U.S. was 26 million barrels.
The more than half decline in rail shipments is due to a few things. First, U.S. oil is no longer ridiculously cheap compared with global prices, so no more buying spree. Second, lower oil prices overall have slowed production, so there's been less of a glut to move. And then there's this reason.
Additionally, new pipelines are still getting built, further pushing down the need for crude by rail.
Adam Bedard is CEO of ARB Midstream, a company that invests in pipelines and rail facilities. Once they're built, pipelines are much cheaper ways to transport crude. More have finally come online. Bedard says the biggest impact to crude by rail would happen if the embattled Dakota Access Pipeline begins operation later this year. It would provide space for a lot of crude to move east from the Bakken.
Those barrels will have to come from somewhere. And it is our view that a lot of those barrels come from crude by rail. The Dakota Access Pipeline can move up to 450,000 barrels a day.
That's the lion's share of what crude by rail is currently moving. Even as pipelines reduce the amount of oil being shipped via rail, the decrease isn't everywhere. Canada is expected to see an increase in such traffic because it doesn't have as much pipeline infrastructure. And the U.S.'s West Coast also isn't seeing a decline. Its pipelines are largely isolated from the rest of the country. Plus, Brett Vandenhoevel of Columbia Riverkeeper worries the current lull may not stay.
You know, that number could ramp back up as production increases.
He's fighting to keep more oil terminals from being built in his area that would bring more trains if production does increase. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Full disclosure, as we get going into this next item, I spent 8 years in the United States Navy, almost three of them stationed at the Pentagon. It was an interesting experience, shall we say. Rosa Brooks did a stint at the Pentagon as well as a civilian counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Her experiences there are the foundation for a new book about the way the American military does what it does today, which is a whole lot. It's called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Rosa, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai.
I'm going to start with a question about the civilian-military divide in this country, which my guess would be that you will agree is real, but let me get your sense. Do you think American civilians, when they think about the Pentagon and the American military, do you believe that they have an understanding of how it works and how it goes about its business?
Not really. I think Americans know roughly as much about the military as if they know about the surface of the moon. and they're as respectful and interested, but just about as ignorant.
Okay, so let's get down to brass tacks here. Tell me about this thing you call the Walmartization of the American military.
Yeah, it's actually a phrase that was coined by my friend, retired Lieutenant General Dave Barno, who says, look, the military has become the nation's one-stop shopping. There's absolutely nothing the American military doesn't do now. Hmm. It sponsors micro-enterprise programs for Afghan women, does anti-piracy patrols, monitors emails of suspected terrorists, trains Iraqi judges, you name it, the military is doing it. Much like Walmart, the more you do, on the one hand, you can exploit these incredible economies of scale, but the more you do, the more likely you are to do everything not all that well, and it has some impacts on other agencies, too.
I'm going to roll out a phrase here that certainly has been around for a very long time, but in my experience dates to the days of Colin Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. It's a recipe for mission creep.
And there's nothing necessarily wrong with mission creep as long as you pay attention to where you're creeping to and you're sure it's a place that you're willing to go and you're willing to make the trade-offs associated with going there. I mean, I think what's been happening, unfortunately, is that we haven't really shifted military recruitment, training, personnel policies as much as we ought to if we think this is what we want the military to be doing in the future. And meanwhile, we've been letting our civilian agencies, foreign policy agencies such as the State Department, USAID, really stagnate and decline.
Right.
It's a commonly said, and it is in fact true, that there are more members of military marching bands than there are members of the U.S. Foreign Service. They just can't keep up.
Of which, again, full disclosure, I was a member of the Foreign Service for 4 years. I've got
well,
all the bases covered on this
interview.
Yeah, right. So what's the answer then? Do we like privatize and pull out and leave it to NGOs and you know, contractors and all that? I mean, we saw in Iraq how that went, and it was not always good.
Yeah, I don't think there's a single right answer. I don't think God came down and said the military must do X and Y, shoot people and can't do anything else. The State Department can only do these things and nothing else. You know, we get to decide that. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with deciding that we want our military to forever take on this wider range of activities. But if that's what we want, let's say that. And let's organize accordingly, budget accordingly, train accordingly, and have democratic oversight mechanisms that are consistent.
I would ask you at this point to look across the Potomac River from the Pentagon to Capitol Hill and explain for me the role of the Congress of the United States. Because, you know, for as much as everybody complains about the Pentagon budget, no small part of that is members of Congress saying, I want the Lockheed to be built in my district, and the other guy talking about this new generation surface ship to be built in his district. District,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And this is not a market economy that we're talking about here.
Right.
The fundamental problem is this, that practically every member of Congress has either a military base or somebody manufacturing military aircraft or something like that in their constituency. Absolutely nobody has a factory manufacturing foreign service officers in their constituency. So all the incentives run in the direction of Congress throwing money at the military, whether the military wants it or not.
It's a book called How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything, Tales from the Pentagon by Rosa Brooks. She was a counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. She is, in real life, a professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. Rosa, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
We've got an excerpt of Rosa Brooks' new book at our website if you want to take a peek, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a lesson in unintended consequences with a hat tip to our colleagues at the BBC and our digital team here at Marketplace. You have seen the controversy perhaps about Muslim women in France not being allowed to wear the burkini, the clothing that allows them to hit the beach but still only show their face, hands, and feet. Turns out, according to the Australian woman who claims the trademark on the name burkini, turns out online sales of that outfit are up 200%. Wall Street was watching and waiting today for Janet Yellen, her speech on Friday out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. As a result, the Dow off a 3rd percent, about 65 points. The Nasdaq down 0.8%, 42 points. The S&P 500 gave back 0.5%. That is 11 points. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.